Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Human achievement can be slow. 200,000 years to go from the wheel to your jalopy? Really? But today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply. When AI is everywhere, every process can be automated and accelerated. 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 UiPath, the AI everywhere foundation of innovation.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I wonder if you've got the guts to lead a big Air Force. If you haven't, I'll get someone who has.
Yeah, I felt that one was the most appropriate. I felt that worked. You really were Tui Spots.
Just for one second, completely channeling the man.
You had transformed.
So welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk, the fifth part in our series about the Mighty Eighth. And last week, or in the last episode, we sort of hinted that this moment was coming because This is quite extraordinary. In the last episode, we talked about how the US 8th Air Force have undergone they've shed their skin or grown a new tail or something. If they were they some sort of lizard of some kind, or they're a salamander been thrown into the fire and they've emerged afresh or something, you know.
Some such
mythical rebirth has occurred.
A phoenix arising from the flames.
Yeah, from its near-death experience. Because not only is there's been sort of change combing through the ranks by virtue of the incredible, colossal and all-encompassing expansion that the 8th Air Force has undergone in the months following Schweinfurt II and the sort of reborn thrust of what they're going to do into the new year of 1944, but also there's been change at the top as Ira Eaker has had to pack his bags, and he's been replaced by the living legend that is Jimmy Doolittle. But even a figure so colossal and undeniable in American aviation, who else would you get in to do this job? Who could possibly deny him what he's trying to do? And yet, Spots is having a moment's wobble, isn't he?
He is. It's only the 24th of January. And if you think Doolittle arrives on the 5th of January, so that's not even 3 weeks he's been in post. And already Spots is going, you know, I wonder if you've got the guts to lead a big Air Force. And this is because there's been a couple of times where they've all been sent out on missions and then recalled. And Spots doesn't think that Doolittle is showing the relevant amount of
application.
Press on, yeah. Application. You know, it's the press on factor. There's not enough Guy Gibson in him. And, of course, this really, really stings Doolittle, who is a personal friend of Spots and, you know, is absolutely an aggressive air leader.
Man flew to Tokyo, for heaven's sake.
It really hurts. But these comments, and you get these flare-ups occasionally in high command, are indicative of the enormous importance that's been placed on air power, and specifically clearing Northwest Europe of the Luftwaffe.
Yeah. And the pressure they put themselves under.
The huge pressure they're under, because it is now going to be June, but the Overlord is going to be June, but it's, you know, time is running out. You know, they've got to clear the skies by the middle of April, absolutely at the latest. And the reason you've got to do that is because you then need a kind of 9-week period in which, before D-Day, in which you can concentrate the bombers on blowing up these bridges across the Seine and the Loire and you know, marshalling yards and all the rest of it, which will be all part of the kind of slowing up the German ability to get to the bridgehead of Normandy once D-Day actually happens. And that's why you need the Luftwaffe clear of Northwest Europe, because if you're doing that low-level precision bombing, it's worth just going through this again. If you're going to do that low-level precision bombing, you can't have Fokker Wolfs and Messerschmitt 109s hovering above you, because you'll just get absolutely destroyed. So this is why it's so important. The truth is, the weather over Europe, I've said it before, I'll say it again, was dreadful in the winter of 1943-1944, and that applied to a huge swathe of Europe. And in January 1944, most of Northwest Europe was covered in snow and freezing conditions, but it wasn't that sort of beautiful, crystal-clear days. It was lots of cloud. And as the Americans had discovered, their precision bombing wasn't anything like as precise as it needed to be when there was lots of cloud. You just couldn't see diddly squat. You needed to have visual eye contact on the target. And therein lies the rub.
Yeah. If they're getting anywhere, they're doing it on H2X. And they don't call it area bombing. They don't call it blind bombing. They call it, you know, radar guided bombing. But it amounts to area bombing. And also, I mean, I think one of the really interesting things about the American approach to this, because they've wedded to precision bombing, what they're not doing is building bigger and bigger mad bombs like the RAF have done. You know, the idea is you drop your standard bomb with precision on a Messerschmitt factory and you knock it out. And so what you don't need is the kind of munitions that Bomber Command have been developing in order to increase the bang for buck, because you know you're not going to hit your target. Or you've generalized your target. You've accepted that what you're doing is bombing people.
But it goes back to that same old point we were making earlier, that all these crews that are coming over, these new bomb groups and new replacement crews that are coming over, they're all training in the United States in crystal clear skies and over kind of vast, flat areas of nothing. So it's comparatively straightforward to use your Norden Bombsight and your do actually visual navigation and drop the bomb in the pickle barrel. But it ain't so easy when you're over Europe and it's January 1944. And it's quite interesting because although Doolittle's very stung by this, a few days later, Spots goes, come on, you're coming with me and we're going to go in Boots and we're going to go and do a tour of the frontline units. And Boots is his own personal B-17, Spots is B-17. And they head off and the weather's absolutely terrible. And most people, when you think terrible weather, you think sleeting rain and high winds and all the rest of it. That's not the problem. The problem is fog and mist and low cloud. No one can see anything. It's just like this huge shroud has descended over England, the North Sea, and Europe. And if there's one thing that's guaranteed to make everyone crash, it's a fog. And what happens is they take off and they just about make the first airbase on the list. And they come in and it's all a bit touch and go. But undeterred, they take off and manage to make the second. But it's even more hairy getting in. The fog is, you know, the visibility is even less. And clearly they're kind of, you know, this is a needless risk. And they have to abandon the third one. And afterwards, Spatz says, do you want to use your Spatz voice again?
You were right, Jim. I see what you mean about uncalculated risks. Coming to a cinema near you.
So the 8th is still going out on raids, but it's very much here and there and hit and miss. And, you know, January passes and there's still no obvious weather window for Operation Argument.
I mean, an example of how bad... I mean, in September, they bomb Emden blind with H2X, and it's a butt report level of accuracy. So that, you know, when the weather's bad, you can't hit anything. And the Americans are judging their bombing offensive as much around their motives as their results, aren't they? They're not in this the crews are not in this to just kill German civilians. They're wedded to the idea that they're doing precision strikes. So you've got, when it's not going that well, you've got to make it work is the simple truth. And if what you're trying to do is destroy the Luftwaffe, you've got to make that work. Otherwise, the whole thing is an empty exercise. Is the truth.
And there's two points here. So Operation Argument, the whole point about Operation Argument is this is supposed to be a week or, you know, 5 days at least of very, very intensive point blank targets. So deep into the Reich, hitting assembly plants, component plants, factories, drawing up the Luftwaffe themselves into the scrap, all the rest of it. That's the point of Operation Argument. Now, the clock is absolutely ticking. April's not very far away. June is not very far away. And I absolutely can see the pressure and why they're all getting twitchy. And yet, the longer they leave it, the more Mustangs there are, the more bombers there are, the better the weather's going to be, the longer the days, the more the opportunities are there. And the better fettle the 8th Air Force will be in to carry out this. And if they're saying we only need a week to do this, it doesn't really matter when that week is, whether it's March or February or January. The point is, you absolutely have to hold your nerve and launch this week when the conditions permit. And actually, if I was going back in time, I would say to Spots and I would say to Jimmy Doolittle, just chill. It's going to be fine. That gap will come. Just hold your nerve and take comfort that the longer you leave it, the better the results will be.
But also, you're confident in the fact that even if you leave it another couple of weeks, the Luftwaffe haven't got time to, aren't benefiting from the same kind of replenishment and float. You know, it's this sort of boat being floated by resupply and the antidote to it. I mean, it's after all, towards the end of the last episode, it was about halfway through. Our last episode, we will confess that this is meant to be part two of the last episode, but we found there was too much to contain. This is the 5 points that Arnold says, you know, that we can take care of your attrition. We are now furnishing fully all the aircraft and crews to take care of your attrition. So the point is, wait and there'll be more. So don't worry about rushing. I mean, I think it's very interesting because
go on.
Well, because we've often talked on the podcast about strategic momentum and how what you have to do is keep pushing because you're committed, you know, which is a big part of how the Italian campaign pans out, doesn't it? The Allies are committed to Sicily, so they're inevitably committed to Italy, so they're inevitably committed to what they then end up doing. And this is an example of that. But actually, the way this works, in a sort of peculiar way, the air battle is now like a naval battle, isn't it? Where you sally out with your fleet and hope to attract the attention of the defender's fleet, isn't it? It's like an old-fashioned naval encounter in that regard. So you wait for when the weather will favour you, rather than just sticking the planes up and hoping for the best.
Well, yes. And the other thing that they would take comfort from, if only they knew it, but they don't, is that the Germans are doing quite well destroying lots of aircraft all on their own without any help from the Americans at all.
That's right.
Yes. And the staggering fact is that in January 1944, more Luftwaffe pilots are killed and planes lost due to accidents and flying mishap than are shot down out of the sky. And obviously, in part, that's a reflection of the lack of action from the point of the 8th Air Force. But it's also indicative of a Luftwaffe, which is absolutely stuffed. It's losing all its cohesion and it's losing its skill. And it is interesting that in all of 1943, just 12% of the Luftwaffe's pilots shoot down 90% of the aircraft, enemy aircraft. So you've got these experts and these aces who are still brilliant, and there are still some of them left in early 1944. But these are inevitably getting whittled away by the fact that the Luftwaffe treats their pilots so badly and just keeps them flying and flying and flying. So inevitably, you shoot down. I mean, we've talked about Heinz Nocker before, who's this Staffel Kapitän, squadron commander. And, you know, I counted out he was sort of shot down 5 times by the middle of February 1944. You know, and literally sort of 3 times between October 1943 and January 1944. I mean, it's literally every other time he goes up, he's shot down. So and he gets away with it, but lots on. That's the point.
Well, and part of it is if you're fighting in bad weather, then things like icing and misting cockpit windows and guns jamming and engines misfiring and all that sort of stuff are all multiplied. So, I mean, the Germans are churning out fighters in vast amounts.
Huge numbers.
But the problem is there's a shortage of spares. There's a shortage of skilled ground personnel. Because after all, you know, also tons of personnel have been drawn into anti-aircraft duty too, into flak duty. So
and also to fill new Fallschirmjäger divisions and Luftlander divisions and Luftwaffe field regiments.
I mean, between
all the rest of it.
September and December, the Germans lose 970 aircraft in combat. 967.
Between when?
September and December, they lose 967 aircraft in combat and a further 1,052 to accidents.
Okay, so in February 1944,
yeah.
which also includes the kind of operation argument, total Luftwaffe losses of all types were 2,605, of which 1,277 were enemy action, and incredibly, 1,328 were due to accidents and other causes. 80% of those losses in the West.
Yeah. In 1942, a German fighter pilot gets 210 hours training, and in 1944, it's 112.
If they're lucky.
So this is the point, is that if you're trying to fight, it's more difficult fighting in winter. It just is. And it makes, if you're a less experienced pilot, that's much more. Operational training is reduced from 50 hours to 20.
So the big gulf is, and this is why it's fighter pilots, not bombers, that are the key to all this. So there is this huge quantitative increase in the numbers of the Luftwaffe, but a huge qualitative decrease. Whereas in the 8th Fighter Command, the fighter wing of the 8th Air Force, there is a huge quantitative increase and a qualitative increase. And that's a winning formula. You know, that's the truth.
So what looks like the Germans winning in the autumn of 43 is kind of an illusion, really, isn't it?
It's illusion. It's papering over vast cracks, which are about to kind of break wide open.
To the point where Goering, when long-range American fighters crashed near Aachen, Goering says, they've been blown there by the wind, by the prevailing wind. They haven't got there. They haven't got there because the equipment's up to it, because of technical adaptation. It's a freak occurrence. So they're, you know, as ever.
The commander-in-chief of the Luftwaffe is absolutely on the money.
His ability to accept reality, you know, is done for. And the other thing is they're reliant on these destroyer aircraft, which are perfectly good for tussling with bombers. But when they're up against a maneuverable fighter, it's a different issue. So because you've got 110s and 410s.
Well, we talked about Jim Howard in the last episode. Two of his victories of those six were ME-110s, and one of them was a Ju-88, if I remember rightly, you know, which is a bomber or a night fighter. Anyway, so there we are. So they're waiting for the gap in the weather. January passes into February. February continues. There's still no obvious sign. There's an occasional clear day where they go off. But there's no consecutive days. There's no kind of high pressure coming in that's going to kick out this fog, give them some clear skies. But, you know, this is my point. By the third week of February, 8th has well over 100 long-range P-51s, has two fighter groups now, and the 8th Air Force now has 1,000 bombers it can deploy on any one given day. Not 230, not 315 like it had on the Schweinfurt 1. So it is definitely a blessing in disguise. I mean, you know, try telling that to Doolittle and Spots. I get all that.
Well, I'll try that telling that to any individual crew being having to go, you know, in shitty weather. But
also the other thing is the lack of flying also gives the crews a chance to kind of actually stay put on the ground for a bit. And, you know, every day they're waking up, the same number of people are in the Quonset hut or the Nissen hut, you know, so there isn't that kind of debilitating losses, which is gripping all the bomber groups. So from a morale point of view, things are kind of sort of, you know, it's hardly swimming, but it's the graph is heading in the right direction. And then suddenly, in the third week of February, it looks like it's all going to be okay. There is the meteorologists come in and go, I think next week's going to be fine. It starts on Saturday, the 19th of February. And actually, Harris, who is so against all this and who has been so cussed and difficult about point blank and sort of paying it lip service only, is given a three-line whip. And it's interesting, as it comes up to Overlord, this idea that Bomber Command is subordinate to the aims of Overlord. You know, he constantly fights it. But one thing I would say about Harris is that when he's given an order and it's a bottom line, he sticks to it to the letter. And so Leipzig is, they want to launch Big Week with a double attack on Leipzig. And the idea about sending Bomber Command over to Leipzig on the night of the 20th of February is that the flak gunners will all have been up all night hammering away at Bomber Command, and they'll be in pieces by the following day when they send over the 8th to attack it as well. So it's a very good idea. And they send up, the RAF sends up 823 bombers. So the idea of sending the best part of kind of 2,000 bombers over in a 24 period, I mean, you know, you think again about those days of the Battle of Britain and summer of 1940 and, you know, the biggest formation on the Sunday the 15th of September being 300 aircraft, of which only 100 were bombers and twin engine bombers. My how things have moved on.
That's the day of great crisis. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? And what on earth the Germans thought they, you know, what kind of critical mass they imagined they had that day, you know, with their light bombers and, you know, with their tactical bombers. Let's face it. It shows in the end, though, that, you know, whatever Germany was able to achieve in 1940 with its smaller resources, it takes a whole lot more to overcome them. You do need the sledgehammer to crack the nut in this instance.
But there's a very, very good... target here at Leipzig, which is the ATG ME-109 assembly plant at Leipzig-Mokau, which is just to the kind of, if I remember rightly, is to the west of Leipzig. And ATG has been completing about 130 ME-109s a month. The Allies know that expansion is planned there. and the final assembly of Ju-88s and Ju-188s has already begun at Leipzig-Mokau. So, you know, this is a very, very good target. And, you know, it's pretty successful, although they do lose 78 bombers. I mean, you know, just think about that. I mean, that's getting on for 10%.
Yes, which is unsustainable. Even though the British are churning out bombers at a great rate, it's still, you can't do that every night, can you? There'll be no one left in short order.
I'll tell you, one of the people who was on that raid incident, it was Rusty Warman, who sadly just passed away a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, really?
Over 100 or whatever. But he was on that raid. He was a lovely chap. All hail to Rusty.
Yeah. But this, if you are the German flak cruiser and you're on the receiving end of this, this is a long day that follows, because the Sunday the 20th, the Americans put up 1,000 bombers and 660 fighters, 12 industrial locations across Germany.
They never, ever, ever hit one target. They have one priority target, but they do lots of different targets. And that's also to just completely scramble the defences and put maximum pressure. I mean, the Americans have a broad front policy on literally everything. And if you've got the numbers, let's bring them to bear in a kind of broader way as possible. So, yeah, so it's 21 US aircraft are lost, which also, I think, I mean, the interesting thing about the 19th, the Bomber Command one on Leipzig to start big week, is that 54 of those 78 are shot down by night fighters.
Right. It's interesting, isn't it? Flak is nothing like as effective, is it? So this is telling you that if you can strike at the fighter arm, then things will go your way.
Well, and what it tells you is that daylight bombing is much, much safer if you've got fighters to protect you. Because if your fighters can take on the enemy fighters, then you're laughing because your fighters are much better than their fighters. So they are going to win that fight. Then you're just taking out a huge... the message of air combat over Europe is that the fighter plane is absolutely key to the whole thing. And what you're seeing in this early part of 1944 is you're seeing that actually at night, Bomber Command can bomb almost as accurately as any American can in daylight. But that actually the original reason for operating at night, it's safer, is now no longer the case, is dwindling. Exactly. So actually only 21 US aircraft are lost, which is, you know, a much, much better story. But on that day, 3 medals of honor awarded to 8 Bomber Command. And I thought, we can't go into lots and lots. We haven't got time to do lots of crew stuff. But I did think we should tell one story.
Well, Bill Lawley's story,
yeah,
is absolutely amazing.
Insane. And this is him and his Lieutenant Bill Lawley, who's the captain of Cabin in the Sky 3, part of the 364th Bomb Squadron in the 305th Bomb Group. In the 1st Division. He's 23 years old. He's from Leeds, Alabama. And I think we'll tell you his story after the break.
Yeah.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Looking to invest? Start your journey by exploring exchange-traded funds with GlobalX ETFs. Exchange-traded funds, or ETFs for short, create baskets of stocks, bonds, and other assets that you can buy in a single trade. GlobalX specializes in ETFs that track emerging trends, like the rise of artificial intelligence, as well as strategies aimed to generate income potential. Visit GlobalXETFs.com to discover how you can get started.
Hi, I'm Ben. I suffer from a condition called writer's block. It strikes when I'm at work. That's why I choose Canva Magic Write. It works fast, generating texts in seconds, thanks to AI.
Common side effects include increased productivity, compliments from coworkers, feelings of satisfaction.
Now I can say bye-bye to writer's block.
Ask your boss if Canva Magic Write is right for you at canva.com, designed for work.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. We've left you with not a cliffhanger there, because this story, this is absolutely amazing. And again, one of these things where you think, how on earth can a person do this? And the fact he's tens of thousands of feet up in the sky when he's doing it as well. It's quite extraordinary.
But also Bill Lawley. So William Lawley is an extraordinary guy because he's so middle of the road, it's not true.
Yeah.
You know, he's bright, but he's not excessively so. He's lean, you know, he's physically okay, but he doesn't, you know, he's hardly a kind of beefcake.
Yeah.
He's just a quiet, self-effacing, minds his P's and Q's, doesn't rot the boat, you know, just a total kind of midstream kind of person. There's nothing in his life up to this point that suggests that he is especially remarkable in any way. Just a really good, solid, middle-of-the-road kind of guy. So they fly over in with their crew in Cabin in the Sky, which they christened back in the United States. When they get over to the UK, they immediately hand it over and say, that's that. So when they then join the 364th Bomb Squadron of the 305th Bomb Group, they get another one, which they then christen Cabin in the Sky 2. They then go on leave in January, I think it is, and another crew takes it out and promptly loses it, gets shot down, and that's that, I think, on their first mission. So they've just that morning, or the day before, got a new one. Cabin in the Sky 3 is brand new, hasn't been painted up or anything. They haven't tried it. They've literally barely taken it out for a flight at all.
Yeah.
And then the target is Leipzig, and they're told that the flak is not going to be too bad because the flak crews will be exhausted off the RAF. The snow everywhere. They're told that they're targeting the same factory complex that Bomber Command did at Leipzig-Mokau. That's the target for the 1st Division, the B-17s. And they're carrying 2.5 tons of bombs. And they take off and everything's absolutely fine. And they reach the IP, which is the initial point, the beginning of the bomb run. And all is going fine. They're in a tight formation.
That's where he hands over to the bombardier to fly the aircraft.
Yep. And the bombardier is Henry Mason. And he announces over the intercom that the bomb bays are open. You know, the sort of out come the electric hydraulics, which open the bomb bays. And Mason can see the target really clearly. And he presses down on the bomb release and goes, bombs away, but nothing happens. So they go again, they try again, he shuts the bomb bays again, opens them again, tries to rest release, and nothing's happening.
Yeah.
And this is your absolute worst nightmare. Basically, what's happened is the bombs have frozen in their racks.
Yeah.
Despite the weight,
yeah,
they're so frozen, they just won't come loose. And the problem is everyone else is losing theirs. And the moment you lose theirs, of course, you're lighter.
You're off.
And you can climb and you're off and you can accelerate by 25 miles an hour, 25 knots. So suddenly everyone is getting ahead of them and they're losing formation and they're starting to lag. And just like a straggler on a transatlantic convoy is always going to be more vulnerable, absolutely the case with a bomber. The straggler is the one that gets picked off. It just in any walk of life, just as the straggler wildebeest will get picked off by the hyenas. Get
and the plane's off by the hyenas. Serengeti.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
exactly,
yeah.
The Serengeti. Exactly. Where you see wild animals. Hyena, lion.
Stop it, Jim. They're falling back. And even though we've talked about how
the most dangerous animal of all is
the FW-190.
Yes, FW-190 is the most dangerous beast of all if you're in a B-17 flying fortress. Yeah.
But although we've talked about the Luftwaffe being you know, basically at its tipping point in the other direction, a swarm of FW-190s to a straggling bomber is very, very, very bad news. And they
very bad news. It's the worst news of all.
It is bad.
It's bad. Not a good so thing. Bad. So, so bad.
So bad. So, so, so bad. So bad.
Yeah. All that.
And, you know, it's kind of like an everything that can go wrong. This is a pure Murphy's Law situation, isn't it? The bomb racks won't open, which means you get delayed. And if you get delayed, although we've talked about how the defensive bomber formation doesn't necessarily deliver everything that's been expected for it. It's even worse if you're out of it, isn't it? Because then you're just defending yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Don't get me wrong. I mean, absolutely it is. And actually, if you're in the middle of the formation, you're probably going to, you know, the chances are you are going to be okay.
Yeah.
It's people around the edges of the box that are most likely to be hit. I mean, not entirely, but
so the tail gunner doesn't see the swarm of FW-190.
Alfred Wendt. Yeah, Alfred
Wendt. Because he's blinded by the sunshine. So the fortress ahead of them is hit, falls away in flames. There's flak bursting nearby. Shrapnel hits an outer engine. outer engine catches fire.
So suddenly a bad situation has just got 80% worse because you can fly even slow. You know, your speed is affected even more if you're only operating on three engines rather than four, and you still got your bombs. I mean, it literally couldn't be worse.
And so, well.
Well, first of all, though, he talks to his co-pilot, because in B-70s Americans, they always have two pilots, two sets of controls. And his co-pilot is Lieutenant Paul Murphy. And he goes, right, get that onboard extinguisher straight away. And this does work, but in the process of doing that, loses them yet more power and speed. And suddenly more fighters are homing in. And the gunners along the waist section and the upper and the ball turret in the bottom are all calling out furiously. And then suddenly more FW-190s suddenly up ahead, little sort of dark specks which suddenly get bigger and bigger and bigger and glint in the afternoon sun, flashes from the gun ports, and suddenly there's a loud crack at the front of the plane, and Lawley's vision goes completely black. And moments later, could have been a few seconds, could be a minute, he comes to finds Murphy's body slumped forward minus his head. So basically his head has been
blown off.
Completely blown to smithereens.
And there's blood and debris all over the interior of the cockpit, on the windscreen and everything.
And just imagine the shock of that. One minute you're talking to the guy, the next minute his head isn't there and it's splattered all over the thing, and there's blood absolutely everywhere. And worse, he's leaning on the controls. So they're now in a screaming dive because the weight of his body has pushed the controls forward.
With the second engine on fire, Lawley himself is injured in the face and his right arm. So he's badly injured himself too. So as they go into this dive with a G-force gathering,
a sort of screaming death dive,
force Murphy's body off the second control column. Right?
With his bad arm, he pulls him back. And with his other arm, pulls back on the controls, desperately trying to get it out of its dive. And amazingly, he does just start to get a bit of control. But at the same time, he thinks they're stuffed, so he calls all the men to bail. Says, right, we're going to have to bail out. And Henry Mason lifts the nose hatch to jump. And navigator Henry Seraphine behind him. But before they jump, Lawley managed to regain quite a lot of control. And suddenly it's starting to level out, and it's sort of okay. And actually emerging from the dive, and both the engine fires are out. So Mason clambers back up into the cockpit and goes back to check on the men, and he discovers that two of the crew members are really badly wounded, and there's absolutely no chance at all of them being able to make a jump.
Yeah.
So that then puts the burden of responsibility back onto Lawley. You know, if he's still thinking about jumping out, well, he can't because they won't be able to. So he's got to, and he is flying straight and level, albeit in a very, very badly wounded and stricken B-17. So he thinks, well, let's see what we can do. But obviously now they're flying on two, not four engines. So after that dive, they're quite low, so he stays quite low. Sub-freezing winds howling through a hole in the windscreen. He's feeling faint because he's got lots of splinter wounds and blood running down
blood
his face.
Blood and shock and everything, yeah.
And shock and everything. I mean, just absolutely horrendous. You know, Paul Murphy is still sitting next to him, headless.
Yeah.
With sort of gore all over the place. I mean, it's scene from a kind of the most horrible horror movie ever.
And he ties Lawley to his chair, doesn't he, with his parka to stop
Murphy, yes. Yeah.
It's Murphy, exactly. Rather. He ties Murphy to his chair to stop him slumping forward.
Mason does this.
Parka.
Mason does
I mean, it's let's see if they get home, shall we?
Quite. So the other problem is that when they opened the hatch, all Seraphine's maps flew out.
Oh, for God's sake.
So they haven't got any maps either. So they're having to navigate by compass and by memory.
Yeah.
And just as they're kind of going across France, they managed to get rid of the bombs. That finally the bomb, you know, there's lower temperatures, I suppose, down at closer to the ground. And finally they drop the bombs in a field somewhere over France. And then suddenly a whole load of more Messerschmitt 109s come towards them, and they just think, oh my God, this is toast.
Yeah.
But just at the last moment, they turn away. And obviously they don't have enough fuel. And they can see that this plane is absolutely stuffed anyway, so it's probably not going to make it. So it's not worth the risk. So that is one bit of luck. And eventually they do manage to reach the Channel coast. The only person who, incidentally, who hasn't been wounded at all is Henry Mason, the bombardier. And they finally reach the Channel, and they cross over near Dover. And by this point, Lawley is so weak that he repeatedly passes out. And Mason has to sit with him and kind of sort of shake him out of his consciousness. But Mason knows that, but Lawley knows he can't have any morphine because that'll do for him. So he's got to fight through the pain, through the exhaustion, through the shock, the loss of blood and all the rest of it, and feeling extremely woozy. And by this point, only one engine is working.
Yeah.
And fighting the aircraft, yeah.
Yeah.
So they're flying at nearly 1,500 feet on just one engine. They cross over the channel. They manage to get over the English coast. They're looking desperately for an airfield, but it's no longer. This is England, and so, of course, there's lots of cloud and mist and stuff, and they can't find it. They finally, suddenly, Lawley spots an airfield, but it's too late. You know, they haven't got the power and the ability to turn back for it. They have to just go in a straight line towards whatever airfield that they see. And he's just thinking, he's got one engine's feathered, another's windmilling, and a third is smoking. And he just doesn't have the control
to
be able to do anything more than the slightest of turns. He certainly can't do a kind of, 180 or anything like that. So he's thinking, well, I'm just going to have to come down in a field. And then miraculously, Manston appears. But their radio is shot out, so they can't do anything. So the only thing they can do is just flash the emergency signal and hope for the best. And they come in and they get lower and lower and lower, and it's wheels up. They can't get the wheels down. It's a belly land, which is dangerous in itself. Hit the ground, massive thump, grinding metal, bent propellers and all the rest of it, screaming and smoking, jolting and juddering. But eventually it reaches a halt. And suddenly there are the fire engines coming out around them. And the amazing thing is that Lawley manages to get off under his own steam. Managed to get out of the ship himself.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And they've made it. And every single person on the plane survives the war, apart from, obviously, Murphy.
Yeah.
Two are injured for life.
Yeah.
But they do all make it. And Lawley, talk about self-effacing. He goes, it was hair-raising, and it was exhilarating, and it was sad, and most any other descriptive term that could be applied to it because of the final results. I ended up with two permanently crippled men on board. However, all did survive other than the co-pilot. Wow.
That's incredible. I mean, the thing is, what this illustrates is even if the battle is, even if the battle is going to go 8th Air Force's way, you've still got that still going to happen. The crews still have to get in a plane and put themselves through the possibility of that kind of thing happening to them.
It hardly bears thinking about, doesn't it?
The bravery and the endurance is absolutely extraordinary.
And so the sustained kind of sort of, I could die any moment sensation that would be going through your mind at that point. The other thing that's really interesting about that raid, that first full day of Big Week, Operation Argument, is that Jimmy Stewart is flying in that day. He's in the 2nd Division because he's in a Liberator.
Looks like we're going to go with the boys. Basically, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
I suppose.
I guess we got to do what we got to do.
What's so wrong with patriotism? That's what I want to know.
What's wrong with...
That's what he said. He said something like that.
I try and do what I can.
When he joined up, he said something like, I don't see why people are so bothered with the idea of patriotism. Really interesting that he would be that on the nose about it.
But on that mission that he is leading in his wing, 13 out of 25 are shot down. So, hats off to Jimmy Stewart. He probably did it.
Yeah.
He's seen his duty and done it.
Yeah. I think it is amazing, the film stars that go, that basically, he trades in, a $2,000 picture career for for the $21 or whatever the men are getting. You know what I mean?
I'm putting his ass on the line. Yeah. We should get back to
Big Week itself.
Big Week. Yeah. So that night, Bomber Command goes out again. 598 bombers attacking Stuttgart and 156 aircraft on diversionary operations. And the second day, Monday, the 21st of February, USAAF, 8th Air Force, sends out 861 bombers again with fighter escorts. The target is the Luftwaffe production center at Brunswick. Again, pretty successful. Tuesday, the 22nd of February, bad weather, but raids continue. Although Nijmegen is accidentally bombed.
Oh, well.
Didn't help Jimmy Gavin later on that year, did it? but also, this is a point that the bombers from the 15th Air Force in Italy start attacking.
Yeah.
So they're part of the picture. And Wednesday, the 23rd, operations are also suspended due to poor weather, which is not good. But then everything's okay again by Thursday the 24th. And this is 266 bombers of the US 8th Air Force sent to hit Schweinfurt.
But it's fine.
It's fine. Yeah. They get away with it. 900 bombers sent to attack a number of aircraft production centers, including Schweinfurt again. So, you know, 900 in total. And that night, 734 bombers of RAF Bomber Command also attacked Schweinfurt.
I mean, if you're in Schweinfurt,
you're having a bad day, aren't you?
Will I ever sleep again? You're thinking.
When will this ever end?
Yeah.
No, it's pretty bad. 24th is a big, big day. And, you know, it is a pretty successful mission, it has to be said. A lot of these planes are getting absolutely hammered. I mean, I remember one of the guys I was writing about in Big Week, a chap called Jim Keefe, who's in the 389th. He comes back with 300 holes in his ship. You know, that's a lot of damage, isn't it?
Yeah, that is. Yes, exactly. But this is interesting, though, because this is round-the-clock bombing, isn't it? This is the thing Ira Aker pitches to Churchill basically a year previously, doesn't he, at Casablanca. This is it, and it's taken a year to get there, but they're achieving it. You've almost 2,000 on the Thursday, the 24th of February. That's almost 2,000 sorties into Germany.
Yep.
Completely round the clock. You know, you've short days, long nights, and you've more than 1,000 American bombers during the day, and, you know, 750 bombers from Bomber Command during the night. The idea that this would not affect the Germans, strategic bombing campaign is somehow. Yep. Some kind of annoyance for the Germans rather than the absolute focus of everything for them on, you know, as a front.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And you're striking hard at the sinew of fighter production, which is like, after all, fighter production is the solution to this problem if you're the Germans. Having more fighter planes is how you respond to this. And then the 25th, another 900 bombers go to Regensburg, Augsburg, and Fort. And then Bomber Command send out 594 bombers to Augsburg. So,
and that's it. That's it for Big Week. Argument is over on that Friday. But
bloody hell, you know, what a week. And obviously this is different to a big thing like Gomorrah the year before, because you can't do that to Hamburg again, can you? You've done it.
Yes, but it's something like 20 different locations that they hit over the course of the week. You have your big ones like Schweinfurt, Regensburg, Leipzig, Brunswick, and whatever. But there's all these other places which are hit as well. And if you're the German leadership and if you're German civilians, as you point out, I mean, this rate of round-the-clock bombing, this scale, we've talked a lot about scale, haven't we, in recent weeks when it comes to the kind of American bomber effort. Here it is. This is a sort of culmination of, 2 years of building up to this, or 18 months, certainly. And it's an astonishing amount. You know, the fact that you're flying 3,300 sorties is a lot. 290 German fighters shot down, 90 damaged. I mean, 226 Allied bombers lost.
Well, yes. I mean, that's the other thing. The losses mount up, but it's the Germans who are... The Germans who can ill afford to, we talked about this before the U-boat war. Actually, it's the people. You can ill afford to, you can't replace the people. You can build a machine quite easily, but if you've a deteriorating supply of people, and also, obviously, this kind of pressure in your airspace is very much treading on what training you can do, isn't it? Let's be honest.
Actually, it can't possibly, and the other thing is, it can't be 3,300 sorties. That's got to be wrong, because there's 3,800 US sorties and 2,351 RAF sorties. So that's 6,000 sorties, isn't it?
Yeah.
And 500 sorties from the 15th Air Force as well.
Yeah.
You know, 10,000 tons of bombs dropped. I mean, that's a lot.
Well, for the Luftwaffe, Doolittle says what hurt the Germans the most was the deterioration in the experience level in their pilots. The Germans had lost an estimated 434 pilots during Big Week out of a total strength of about 2,200. So he's licking his lips at that. They retire the Zastora from bomber encounters because they know it's too vulnerable now, which is a repeat of the Battle of Britain where the ME-110, like, what do we do with this plane now? It's been rendered obsolete by the appearance of a, you know, decent fighter aircraft.
Yeah. So if you include the fighter sorties as well, it's 9,824
Yes.
Sorties. And just for those who don't know, a sortie is an individual aircraft combat flight. So That's not 9,824 separate aircraft, because some of them might have done four trips or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, the best part of 10,000 sorties is a hell of a lot. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you think what that looks like. I mean,
yeah,
going over the skies, that's huge.
One of the interesting statistics here is that Bomber Command, you know, the 8th Air Force and 15th put a lot more, you know, they fly more sorties, 1,500 more. They put 1,500 more aircraft into this offensive than the British do, don't they? So it's 3,800. And yet they kind of drop the same amount of bombs.
And yet the RAF lose 157 bombers and the 8th Air Force loses 137 bombers. What that tells you is when you've got fighter escort, you're not going to get shot down as much.
So
there's so many lessons to be learned from Operation Argument. But the first one is this is working, because droves of German fighter aircraft are coming up to meet all these bomber formations. And American fighter pilots are meeting them and shooting them down, and in very big numbers. When you've got protection, your bombers absolutely can hit the target. So the general idea of that protective box that you're using is still a sound one. But just like a transatlantic convoy, you also need the escorts to protect you. Yeah, that's the truth of the matter. You can't do it on your own, just as you couldn't out at sea either.
And you can't do it with close escort. You have to let the fighters do their thing, basically, don't you? You have to let them go, as it were.
You know, the damage and stuff is really interesting. So this is an 8th Air Force spokesman. Since January the 1st, strategic bombing of Germany by British and American forces has reduced the German two-engine fighter production by 80%, single-engine fighter production by 60%, and in addition, 25% of bomber production has been destroyed. We believe we have fighter production down to the point where the Nazis can't keep up with the losses. We can't help but feel that Germany has lost her last hope of maintaining a successful defense. Well, yes. I mean, and a lot of these big targets, like Leipzig-Mokau, for example, 70% of the aircraft factories are destroyed. There's absolutely no question about that. 700 ME-109s have to be written off that are being assembled or in production. I mean, you know, these are not small figures. American fighters lose 28 fighters. The Germans lose over 500. So that's a ratio of 18-1 superiority.
I mean, that's incredible.
Which tells you all you need to know and reinforces the point we've been repeatedly making, that this is about, you know, the bomber war is about fighters. It is about bombers, of course, but fighters are the key to understanding the whole thing. And yet, in March, German factories are still producing an impressive 2,672 planes. And by July, it's 4,219. But there is still a big gulf between planned production and actual production in the Luftwaffe. And the point is, and this is the really, really important point, is you don't need to destroy all the Luftwaffe to achieve the goals that you need for D-Day. And this is what we'll be looking in the next episode.
You need to keep them busy to the point where...
You need to push them back. You need to push them back into the right. That's what you need to do. And what we'll be looking at in the next episode is what follows Big Week into the spring, the development of the air plan in the run-up to Operation Overlord, and then what happens in the arguments over what targets should be. And there is a kind of debate over this up to D-Day and beyond.
Yeah, and a debate between British boffins and American bomber men and all that sort of stuff. There's a bit of British boffinry to be had in the next episode. I mean, Jim,
but you know, it's interesting because the factories were still producing a large number of fighter aircraft, the naysayers would go, well, you know, Big Week wasn't all it was cracked up to be, and it was a huge amount of effort, and you know, didn't really achieve its goals. Anyone who says that doesn't understand what they're talking about. Big Week is a massive, massive success. It really is, because of the ongoing attrition of the best pilots. And what they're doing is that qualitative loss that the Luftwaffe is suffering takes a massive hit in that week. And I would say that the Big Week is the moment where the quality of the Luftwaffe dips so badly that it's irrecoverable.
Yeah.
And that's the big marker. It's the qualitative standard of the Luftwaffe fighter pilots that's the big deciding factor. But you know, as you pointed out, I mean, 75% of your factory being hit and destroyed is not helpful at a time of total war.
No, it's really, really unhelpful. And you know, people go, look at what they were able to achieve in spite of it. We think, well, what would they have been able to achieve had that campaign not being prosecuted the way it was?
Exactly that.
It's absolutely fascinating. All right, well.
Well, here we are, five episodes down. Got two to come.
Two to come. We promise you some British boffins in the next one. Thanks, everybody, for listening. If you've got this far in and you're happy to wait for the remaining two episodes, then that's up to you. But if not, you can subscribe to our Apple podcast channel, where everything's curated all in one handy bundle too. So our previous runs and on stuff like Dunkirk and basically this bottomless pit that is the Second World War, and without adverts too.
Yep. So you won't hear talking about beer or me talking about diets that I'm not using.
Or impotence or whatever I've been made to talk about.
None of it. None of it.
I don't know why I get those ads. You'll have to deal with...
diets one. I'm getting a bit paranoid.
Everything's curated and searchable on our Apple podcast channel. Or you could subscribe to our Patreon, which is if you go to the Patreon, there's membership for that. There's discussion on there. There's news. There's us doing a live cast every couple of weeks where you can watch us talk like this and interact with us, one of the bits I really love about this podcast is the fact that we have built up, if you're not part of this gang yet, what we call the independent company, listeners who are involved and part of the kind of the dialogue that has grown up around this podcast and the people who prod us into talking about subjects and raising stuff. And then also voting on which is the best general ever, which upsets people, which is part of the fun of this, after all, is the debate and the disagreement as much as anything else. You've been listening to our fifth episode of The Mighty Eighth. Thanks very much for listening. We will see you soon. Cheerio. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.